Again and test. So, okay, reading order first, where we are, as far as I can see, remember, is chapter 8, the Supreme Will, on page 208 on my edition, at least. Supreme Will, chapter 8. Is it right? Okay.
Yes.
So, the order I see. Andrea, me, and then John Robert. Yeah, so I'm sorry, you. Or should we make it the other way around?
It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
So we don't have
Yeah.
Jeffrey Jen to ring our bell. Does someone have a bell on their computer?
Nope. But let me see if I can do this with there was a. Yeah, there is an insight, there is a sort of.
Let's just have 3 minutes meditation. We don't need a bell.
No, yoga. Yeah, for the next time, I will organize me with an app. There's a
Okay.
special app that makes, yeah.
Right.
Let's make 3 minutes. Ding.
Nice.
Yeah. So I can exercise my vocal skills.
Chapter
The
eight.
first time in my life. Yeah.
Chapter eight, the supreme will. In the light of this progressive manifestation of the spirit, first apparently bound in the ignorance, then free in the power and wisdom of the infinite, we can better understand the great and crowning injunction of the Gita to the Karma Yogin. Abandoning all dharmas, all principles and laws and rules of conduct, take refuge in me alone. All standards and rules are temporary constructions founded upon the needs of the ego in its transition from matter to spirit. These makeshifts have a relative imperativeness so long as we rest satisfied in the stages of transition, content with the physical and vital life, attached to the mental movement, or even fixed in the ranges of the mental plane that are touched by the spiritual lusters. But beyond is the unwalled wideness of a supramental infinite consciousness, and there all temporary structures cease. It is not possible to enter utterly into the spiritual truth of the eternal and infinite if we have not the faith and courage to trust ourselves into the hands of the Lord of all things and the friend of all creatures, and leave utterly behind us our mental limits and measures. At one moment, we must plunge without hesitation, reserve or fear or scruple, into the ocean of the free, the infinite, the absolute. After the law, liberty. After the personal, after the general, after the universal standards, there is something greater, the impersonal plasticity, the divine freedom, the transcendent force, and the supernal impulse. After the straight path of the ascent, the wide plateaus on the summit. Wow, that is gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely. There are three stages of the ascent. At the bottom, the bodily life enslaved to the pressure of necessity and desire. In the middle, the mental, higher emotional and psychic rule that feels after greater interests, aspirations, experiences. At the summit, first a deeper psychic and spiritual state, and then a supramental eternal consciousness in which all our aspirations and seekings discover their own intimate significance. In the bodily life, first desire and need, and then the practical good of the individual and the society are the governing consideration, the dominant force. In the mental life, ideas and ideals rule, ideas that are half-lights wearing the garb of truth. Ideas formed by the mind as a result of a growing but still imperfect intuition and experience. Whenever the mental life prevails and the bodily diminishes its brute insistence, man, the mental being, feels pushed by the urge of mental nature to mold in the sense of the idea or the ideal the life of the individual, and in the end, even the vaguer, more complex life of the society is forced to undergo this subtle process. In the spiritual life, or when a higher power than mind has manifested and taken possession of the nature, these limited motive forces recede, dwindle, tend to disappear. The spiritual or supramental self, the divine being, the supreme and immanent reality, must be alone the Lord within us and shape freely our final development according to the highest, widest, most integral expression possible of the law of our nature. In the end, that nature acts in the perfect truth and its spontaneous freedom, for it obeys only the luminous power of the eternal. The individual has nothing further to gain, no desire to fulfill. He has become a portion of the impersonality or the universal personality of the eternal. No other object than the manifestation and play of the divine spirit in life and the maintenance and conduct of the world in its march towards the divine goal can move him to action. Mental ideas, opinion, constructions are his no, sorry, mental ideas, opinions, constructions are his no more. For his mind has fallen into silence. It is only a channel for the light and truth of the divine knowledge. Ideas are too narrow for the vastness of his spirit. It is the ocean of the infinite that flows through him and moves him forever. Yeah, there would be already a lot to discuss about, but I don't know if you, this is the first section. Should we proceed? I think yes, yeah.
I'd like to just say that Sri Aurobindo's poetic sense really comes out in these two paragraphs.
Yeah, I like also this expression. Ideas that are half lights wearing the garb of truth. Only about this sentence one can write a tome, I think. What does it mean, the garb of truth? Huh? Yeah, that everything on our mental level appears to be true, but even that is still a garb. It's still a half light garb, half truth, and that's I can imagine a lot of things were in our society. Also, the best ideas are still half truths because after a while you discover that there are also the dark side of the best idea, dark side. Yeah. Wonderful.
I've been reading the mother's notes on the way from her collected works, portions of her discussions with Satpram about her sadhana. And she says over and over again how the mental world, the old world that she is leaving and coming into this new world is really flat and false. So she takes her words farther than a half-truth or the half-light. She says it's ridiculous. When looked from that viewpoint, what we consider truth or what we consider important or all the rest of that.
Yeah, but the question is, as long as we are in this, how can we say, mental consciousness, ordinary consciousness, human consciousness, I think it's unavoidable that nevertheless we have to still regard some things more truthful than others, which is obviously just a matter of opinion, a subjective opinion, of course. But it is still the thing that I cannot see how we can say, well, it's all falsehood or no falsehood or it's equal. Yeah, we had already bits this discussion, no? But does this mean that we have to regard everything as true or false or just neither that nor that.
Maybe we can learn. Maybe we can learn to see. First of all, we do the best we can, right, with the consciousness we have.
Exactly.
So, and the more silent we become, maybe the more access we have. I think just being aware that all of our mental understanding is limited. It's not necessarily false, right? But it is limited.
Yeah.
And then sure. to keep coming back to silence for guidance.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need to do a black and white thinking, of course, is very common, but that's, we don't need to do that at all.
Yeah.
You know, we can transcend that more easily than just having a bit of a vaster perception. Yeah. Do the best we can.
Okay, I think we should, yeah. Nevertheless, do the best we can means that every one of us still has to consider some things more truthful and less truthful.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of... Well,
you feel it, well, right? You feel it.
Yeah. It's something that I feel. It is a mind that would like to flatten everything and say, no, that's...
Right, to do the black and white thing.
Or only black or only white or no colors at all. Yeah. But would like to flatten everything and think, since there is, we can, or at least we cannot see what the truth is, or maybe there is no truth at all. Everything is the same. This thinking of sameness. We are limited, but there can be a more wider or less wider limitation. Huh? If the supramental is infinite, there is this limitation, but there is also this little limitation. So this limitation here is a little bit more truthful than this limitation. So, these are things that's so... Here we are. I'm trying to rationalize them, but fortunately, Geoffrey was not here. He would have jumped immediately on this. we will discuss this next time because maybe it's not.
Let's read it again next time when he's with us.
Eventually,
This is really gorgeous.
Yeah. And you can also read very well on there. You have some tone.
Well, I'm really with it.
You should read all the synthesis of yoga. And we should put it online as a reading to the public. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, John Robert.
Whoever sincerely enters the path of works must leave behind him the stage in which need and desire are the first law of our acts. For whatever desires still trouble his being, he must, if he accepts the high aim of yoga, put them away from him into the hands of the Lord within us. The supreme power will deal with him for the good of the sadhaka and for the good of all. In effect, we find that once this surrender is done, always provided the rejection is sincere, egoistic indulgence of desire may for some time recur under the continued impulse of past nature, but only in order to exhaust its acquired momentum and to teach the embodied being in his most unteachable part, his nervous, vital, emotional nature, by the reactions of desire, by its grief and unrest bitterly contrasted with calm periods of the higher peace or marvelous movements of divine ananda, that egoistic desire is not a law for the soul that seeks liberation or aspires to its own original God nature. Afterwards, the element of desire in those impulsions will be thrown away or persistently eliminated by a constant denying and transforming pressure. Only the pure force of action in them, pravritti, justified by an equal delight in all work and result that is inspired or imposed from above, will be preserved in the happy harmony of a final perfection. To act, to enjoy, is the normal law and right of the nervous being. But to choose by personal desire its action and enjoyment is only its ignorant will, not its right. Alone the supreme and universal will must choose. Action must change into a dynamic movement of that will. Enjoyment must be replaced by the play of a pure spiritual ananda. All personal will is either a temporary delegation from on high or a usurpation by the ignorant asura.
The social law, that second term of our progress, is a means to which the ego is subjected in order that it may learn discipline by subordination to a wider collective ego. This law may be quite empty of any moral content and may express only the needs or the practical good of the society as each society conceives it. Or it may express those needs and that good, but modified and colored and supplemented by a higher moral or ideal law. It is binding on the developing but not yet perfectly developed individual in the shape of a social duty, family obligation, communal or national demand, so long as it is not in conflict with his growing sense of the higher right. But the sadhaka of the karma yoga will abandon this also to the Lord of works. After he has made his surrender, his social impulses and judgments will, like his desires, only be used for their exhaustion, or it may be, so far as they are still necessary for a time, to enable him to identify his lower mental nature with mankind in general, or with any grouping of mankind in its works and hopes and aspirations. But after that brief time is over, they will be withdrawn, and the divine government will alone abide. He will be identified with the divine and with others only through the divine consciousness and not through the mental nature.
For even after he is free, the sadhaka will be in the world, and to be in the world is to remain in works. But to remain in works without desire is to act for the good of the world in general, or for the kind or the race, or for some new creation to be evolved on the earth, or some work imposed by the divine will within him. And this must be done either in the framework provided by the environment or the grouping in which he is born or placed, or else in one which is chosen or created for him by a divine direction. Therefore, in our perfection, there must be nothing left in the mental being Therefore, in our perfection, there must be nothing left in the mental being which conflicts with or prevents our sympathy and free self-identification with the kind, the group, or whatever collective expression of the divine he is meant to lead, help, or serve. But in the end, it must become a free self-identification through identity with the divine, and not a mental bond or moral tie of union or a vital association dominated by any kind of personal, social, national, communal, or creedal egoism. If any social law is obeyed, it will not be from physical necessity or from the sense of personal or general interest or for expediency or because of the pressure of the environment or from any sense of duty, but solely for the sake of the Lord of works and because it is felt or known to be the divine will that the social law or rule or relation as it stands can still be kept as a figure of the inner life and the minds of men must not be disturbed by its infringement. If, on the other hand, the social law, rule, or relation is disregarded, that too will not be for the indulgence of desire, personal will, or personal opinion, but because a greater rule is felt that expresses the law of the spirit, or because it is known that there must be in the march of the divine all will a movement towards the changing, exceeding, or abolition of existing laws and forms for the sake of a freer, larger life necessity to the world's progress.
There is still left the moral law, or the ideal, and these, even to many who think themselves free, appear forever sacred and intangible. But the sadhaka, his gaze turned always to the heights, will abandon them to him whom all ideals seek imperfectly and fragmentarily to express. All moral qualities are only a poor and rigid travesty of his spontaneous and illimitable perfection. The bondage to sin and evil passes away with the passing of nervous desire. For it belongs to the quality of vital passion, impulsion, for it belongs to the quality of vital passion, impulsion, or drive of propensity in us, Rajaguna, and is extinguished with the transformation of that mode of nature. But neither must the aspirant remain subject to the gilded or golden chain of a conventional or a habitual or a mentally ordered or even a high or clear sattvic virtue. That will be replaced by something profounder and more essential than the minor inadequate thing that men call virtue. The original sense of the word was manhood, and this is a much larger and deeper thing than the moral mind and its structures. The culmination of karma yoga is a yet higher and deeper state that may perhaps be called soulhood. For the soul is greater than the man. A free soulhood, spontaneously welling out in works of a supreme truth and love, will replace human virtue. But this supreme truth cannot be forced to inhabit the petty edifices of the practical reason, or even confined in the more dignified constructions of the larger ideative reason that imposes its representations as if they were pure truth on the limited human intelligence. This supreme love will not necessarily be consistent, much less will it be synonymous, with the partial and feeble, ignorant and emotion-ridden movements of human attraction, sympathy, and pity. The petty law cannot bind the vaster movement. The mind's partial attainment cannot dictate its terms to the soul's supreme fulfillment.
At first, the higher love and truth will fulfill its movement in the sadhaka according to the essential law or way of his own nature. For that is the special aspect of the divine nature, the particular power of the supreme Shakti, out of which his soul has emerged into the play, not limited indeed by the forms of this law or way, for the soul is infinite. But still its stuff of nature bears that stamp, evolved fluently along those lines, or turns around the spiral curves of that dominating influence. He will manifest a divine truth movement according to the temperament of the sage, or the lion-like fighter, or the lover and enjoyer, or the worker and servant, or in any combination of essential attributes, gunas, that may constitute the form given to his being by its own inner urge. It is this self-nature playing freely in his acts which men will see in him, and not a conduct cut, chalked out, artificially regulated by any lesser rule or by any law from outside.
But there is a yet higher attainment. There is an infinity, an antia, in which even this last limitation is exceeded, because the nature is utterly fulfilled and its boundaries vanish. There the soul lives without any boundaries, where it uses all forms and molds according to the divine will in it. But it is not restrained, it is not tied down, it is not imprisoned in any power or form that it uses. This is the summit of the path of works, and this the utter liberty of the soul in its actions. In reality, it has there no actions, for all its activities are rhythm of the Supreme and sovereignly proceed from that alone, like a spontaneous music out of the infinite. Yeah. Again, very poetic language here shines through again. Yeah, powerful, powerful. These are already two sections for me. The one with the nervous vital, and the other is the soulhood. I like the soulhood thing. Any comments?
I love the description of the individual soul, how it evolved fluently, yeah, and that the temper, according to our temperament, you know, we are a particular manifestation of the divine. After all, each one of us is unique in that way. I love that. And the more free we can be of our limitations, the more we can shine in our gifts, right?
Yeah, that's what I see always in education. Huh? The child that is allowed to express more fluently his mm-hmm. soul. Yeah, that we are still, our educational system does still not see that. And that's one of the main line of thoughts is that you can find also in the human cycle the ideal of human unity in Sri Aurobindo's the other two books, and this comes up and up again, the freedom of the soul, but in the dichotomy with the freedom of also of the collective. This is something that comes up again and again in the writings of Sri Aurobindo and transpires also here. And I think, okay, I'm a bit fixed on this this topic, but the educational system, as long as our educational system will not realize this truth, and it has not necessarily to realize it in a spiritual, metaphysical doctrine, it can also realize it from a secular point of view, but it has to realize it, and it still does not realize it. Also, the rest of the collective also will have some problem to grow and evolve. Because if there is not the liberty of the personal soul, there can be also not the soulhood, that the free soulhood that he spontaneous, willing out in works of supreme truth and love, which will replace the human virtue. If it doesn't work at the level of the subject, it cannot also work on the level of the collective. Of course, also the opposite is true. It's both sides. But actually, I think the big hurdle that we have in our society is there in the first years of our life, where we are molded in sections, like a section of a book. Then it's difficult to come out of it.
Yeah, then you spend the rest of your life liberating yourself from all the limitations. But that's exactly. that's a valid journey too. You know, if the soul wants to stay, it'll find its way.
Absolutely.
But when listening to you talking, you know, I'm fortunate, or my daughter is fortunate. She's homeschooling her boys. I see these boys, and I also know a few other children who are raised like that, where they are really free to be and express who they are, to follow their interests, to get all that emotional safety, to shine. And they shine. Those children are happier than, they're just so happy. It's wonderful to see. There's hope. There's hope.
Yeah. The homeschooling thing is also coming up now here also. You know that it's not possible. It's not like in the United States. Here we have this repressive system, which is, it's forbidden.
But you also have some alternative schooling. You have Montessori and what's the other one?
Waldorf.
Yeah,
I have made some experience in the Waldorf schools. Yeah. Okay, Montessori, I think she was much more on the right track,
She was quite enlightened.
Yeah. And by the way, you know that Montessori, she was in contact with Ashram. She also sent a letter to, I don't know if directly to Sri Aurobindo's mother, but to the Ashram, and there is still a letter of her. And she lived in, what is it now, at Madurai?
She did?
It was Madras North, yeah. And she lived there for 3 years.
Oh. Yeah. Was she at the Theosophical Society in Madras?
I don't know about that. But I think she presented herself very secular. She had.
Which was a good thing in society.
Yeah. At that time, already, still today, it's difficult.
Even now.
Yeah. And, but the concept, the background, I think, was the right one. Mm-hmm. The question is, of course, how did they then implement it in the schools? Yeah, because one thing is the theory, another thing is the practice. Mm-hmm. And mother had to deal with that, no? When she was still in her body, and there was a school, there was and still is a school, and what is it named? The school of the ashram, that is just in front of the ashram. And she had hard times to explain to the teachers what education is from the point of view of interior yoga.
Well, all those adults, of course, had been educated in the old system.
And they didn't get it. There's an interesting interview of, you can find it on YouTube. What's his name? Kitu Reddy, who says where there is someone who asks him, but who was making this resistance against them? will of mother. And he says, I was most the most rebellious and was absolutely contrary to her idea of integral education, and I didn't accept it. And only now I begin to understand what it means. Yeah, it's
takes.
Yeah, it takes time. But I think this is what he's speaking about here, the soulhood, and that we have to shift our thinking from a manhood or a mental type organized society to a soul-centered society, which means not that everyone is spiritual, but where we have this understanding that there is a soul factor. Sri Aurobindo called it also soul factor. That our society and our education and also our institutions must somehow respect this soul factor, that if we deny it, ignore it, or even repress it, that on the long run that has devastating consequences, because nature accepts it only for some time, but then overthrows it.
So on a societal level, maybe it would be more acceptable, because one has to be exceedingly careful in society to touch religion, because it always becomes dogmatic. To talk about recognizing the individual uniqueness.
Exactly.
The absolute individual uniqueness of each being, of each child, you would then kind of surreptitiously support their soul, right? Because you're supporting who they are in their essence. And that language might be more appropriate in a societal context. Yes.
Secular language, yes.
I was thinking something along the same lines, because when Sri Aurobindo was talking about the soul of nations, the nation soul, he gave us examples of the first two peoples who started speaking that way, of Bengal and Ireland. And he said what the people said was, we have to be ourselves. We have to be ourselves, not what the king wants or not what the empire wants. We have to be ourselves. And Sri Aurobindo brought that language up in front. Not that there's no skin or cover or veil over the soul, but that is the soul speaking from the depth to out to the surface. And
who were the first?
It's similar to what you're saying, Andrea. The essence of the person.
Who were the first to say that, John Robert?
The Bengalis and the Irish.
Well, Bengalis and Irish are very far away. So,
exactly. Yeah. They're all part of larger nation, but they don't feel they belong, right? Because they're different.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. But I had already a discussion with this type of thinking, and the objection that I received was someone who cited Margaret Thatcher, who said, Margaret Thatcher once, it seems, I don't have the exact citation, I don't know what she exactly said, but they said that Margaret Thatcher said, there is nothing like a society. Society is only just an abstract concept. There are only peoples, and which we in our anthropocentric thinking like to see as an organism, but there is nothing like that.
I don't think Margaret Thatcher was the ultimate of wisdom. She had a lot of power and strong ideas.
Absolutely. But there are a lot of people who believe and think like that. That's the kind of thinking. And it's how do you deconstruct something without falling in a metaphysical discourse?
You don't. You leave it alone.
Yeah. But that's an example where I cannot rationalize it. I cannot deconstruct it analytically, but I feel it to be a falsehood. I feel that there is a sort, Mother spoke even of the psychic of the nations. And we speak of the soul of a nation, the soul of America. Also the Russians speak of the soul of the Russian, of Russia. Yeah, but then this is also entangled with egoistic national thinking. And how do you disentangle, discriminate the two things? And
they say, how do we disentangle our own? So on a nation level, that's huge.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but the objection was that it's only an expression of a national egoism and nothing else. My feeling is, yes, it's true. There is also yet another whale of an expression of national egoism, but this is just one of the garbs. If you take away this garb,
right,
of half light and half truth and half falsehood, deep down, it is also an expression, right, of a psychic, of the soul of a nation. But it's metaphysics. Rational, analytic thinking, scientific thinking, personal, would not accept it. And that's a problem of our society.
Yeah, well, that level.
Yeah,
you can't get it on that level.
We eliminate the soul factor and think all in a mechanistic way. And think that mind is the ultimate tool with which we can regulate everything in our society. And finally, we will find a wonderful, bright future of artificial intelligence and on Mars. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's go on. Who's next? I don't remember.
I think it's my turn.
All right. Okay.
The total surrender. Maybe I'll just stop there. The total surrender, then, of all our actions to a supreme and universal will, an unconditioned and standardless surrender of all works to the government of something eternal within us, which will replace the ordinary working of the ego nature, is the way and end of karma yoga. But what is this divine supreme will, and how can it be recognized by our deluded instruments and our blind, prisoned intelligence? Yes, people want to know.
And argue. Ordinarily, we conceive of ourselves as a separate I in the universe that governs a separate body and mental and moral nature, chooses in full liberty its own self-determined actions, and is independent and therefore sole master of its works and responsible. It is not easy for the ordinary mind, the mind that has not thought or looked deeply into its own constitution and constituents. It is difficult even for minds that have thought but have no spiritual vision and experience to imagine how there can be anything else in us truer and deeper and more powerful than this apparent I and its empire. But the very first step towards self-knowledge, as towards the true knowledge of phenomena, is to get behind the apparent truth of things and find the real but masked, essential, and dynamic truth which their appearances cover.
This ego or I is not a lasting truth, much less our essential part. It is only a formation of nature, a mental form of thought centralization in the perceiving and discriminating mind, a vital form of the centralization of feeling and sensation in our parts of life, a form of physical conscious reception centralizing substance and function of substance in our bodies. All that we internally are is not ego, but consciousness, soul or spirit. All that we externally and superficially are and do is not ego, but nature. Yeah. An executive cosmic force shapes us and dictates through our temperament and environment and mentality, so shaped. An executive cosmic force shapes us and dictates through our temperament and environment and mentality, so shaped. Through our individualized formulation of the cosmic energies, our actions and their results. Truly, we do not think, will, or act, but thought occurs in us, will occurs in us, impulse and act occurs in us. Our ego sense gathers around itself, refers to itself, all that is flow of natural activities. It is cosmic force. It is nature that forms the thought, imposes the will, imparts the impulse. Our body, mind, and ego are a wave of that sea of force in action and do not govern it, but by it are governed and directed. The sadhaka, in his progress towards truth and self-knowledge, must come to a point where the soul opens its eyes of vision and recognizes this truth of ego and this truth of works. He gives up the idea of a mental, vital, physical I that acts or governs action. He recognizes that Prakriti, force of cosmic nature, following her fixed modes, is the one and only worker in him and in all things and creatures.
But what has fixed the modes of nature? Or who has originated and governs the movements of force? There is a consciousness, or a conscient, behind that is the Lord, witness, knower, enjoyer, upholder, and source of sanctions for her works. This consciousness is soul, or Purusha. Prakriti shapes the action in us. Purusha in her, or behind her, witnesses, assents, bears, and upholds it. Prakriti forms the thought in our minds. Purusha in her, or behind her, knows the thought and the truth in it. Prakriti determines the result of the action. Purusha in her, or behind her, enjoys or suffers the consequence. Prakriti forms mind and body, labors over them, develops them. Purusha upholds the formation and evolution and sanctions each step of her works. Prakriti applies the will force which works in things and men. Purusha sets that will force to work by his vision of that which should be done. This Purusha is not the surface ego, but a silent self, a source of power, an originator and receiver of knowledge behind the ego. Our mental eye is only a false reflection of this self, this power, this knowledge. This Purusha, or supporting consciousness, is therefore the cause, recipient, and support of all nature's works, but he is not himself the doer. Prakriti, nature force, in front, and Shakti, consciousness force, soul force, behind her. For these two are the inner and outer faces of the Universal Mother, account for all that is done in the universe. The Universal Mother, Prakriti Shakti, is the one and only worker.
So there. Purusha Prakriti, consciousness force, soul supporting nature. For the two, even in their separation, are one and inseparable, are at once a universal and a transcendent power. But there is something individual too, which is not the mental ego, something that is one in essence with this greater reality. It is a pure reflection or portion of the one Purusha. It is the soul, person, or the embodied being, the individual self, Jivatman. It is the self with capital S that seems to limit its power and knowledge so as to support an individual play of transcendent and universal nature. I want to read that again. It is the self that seems to limit its power and knowledge so as to support an individual play of transcendent and universal nature. In deepest reality, the infinitely one is also infinitely multiple. We are not only a reflection or part of that, but we are that. Our spiritual individuality, unlike our ego, does not preclude our universality and transcendence. But at present, the soul or self in us, intent on individualization in nature, allows itself to be confused with the idea of the ego. It has to get rid of this ignorance. It has to know itself as a reflection or portion or being of the supreme and universal self, and solely a center of its consciousness in the world action. But this Jiva Purusha too is not the doer of works any more than the ego or the supporting consciousness of the witness and knower. Again and always, it is the transcendent and universal Shakti who is the sole doer. But behind her is the one supreme who manifests through her as a dual power, Purusha Prakriti Ishvara Shakti. The Supreme becomes dynamic as the Shakti and is by her the sole originator and master of works in the universe. The Supreme becomes dynamic as the Shakti and is by her the sole originator and master of works in the universe. Wow, it's amazing how he manages to describe this as this oneness as so completely intertwined and supporting of each other. It's difficult for the mind to wrap itself around it.
It may be useful to read also the note, because he has a lot. Yeah. I have a very long note here.
Yeah, yes.
Should I can read it. Huh?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Ishvara Shakti is not quite the same as Purusha Prakriti. It's not the same as Purusha Prakriti, for Purusha and Prakriti are separate powers, but Ishvara and Shakti contain each other. Ishvara is Purusha who contains Prakriti. Ishvara is Purusha who contains Prakriti and rules by the power of the Shakti within him. Shakti is Prakriti ensouled by Purusha and acts by the will of the Ishvara, which is her own will and whose presence in her movement she carries always with her. Purusha Prakriti realization is of the first utility of the seeker on the way of works, for it is the separation of the conscient being and the energy and subjection of the being to the mechanism of the energy that are the efficient cause of our ignorance and imperfection. By this realization, the being can liberate himself from mechanical action of nature and become free and arrive at a first spiritual control over the nature. Ishvara Shakti stands behind the relation of Purusha Prakriti and its ignorant action and turns and its ignorant action and turns it to an evolutionary purpose. The Ishvara Shakti realization can bring participation in a higher dynamism and a divine working and a total unity and harmony of the being in a spiritual nature.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but I didn't get it much. I have to read.
So it's like in the Ishvara Shakti, they are one. They are two aspects. They're the two in one. So that is the highest manifestation. And the Purusha Prakriti is more on a quote-unquote lower level of the manifestation, where they are not necessarily conscious of one another. And that's how we dive into the ignorance. That's what I am reading. And that the yoga is to bring that part in us, our Purusha, yeah, and our Prakriti into a higher united consciousness of the Ishvara Shakti.
Yeah, there's stepping back.
Yeah, I have never understood that before. I'm reading this. I'm sure I've read it once before, but
in fact, I was wondering if this note appeared already in the first edition or if he did add this.
I have later. I don't know if I have the first edition. No, I have the sixth edition.
I don't know what edition.
1976. And I have it in here.
I have the sixth impression. I don't know, but it's 2010.
Yeah. Yeah, mine is the third impression in 1984.
Yeah. Yeah, because
it's good. It's very helpful. I find it very helpful to understand it because those words are thrown around and I get confused. I get confused.
Yeah. I'm in fact trying to make a sort of summary of this cosmology, which I like to call it integral cosmology, but I don't know. And there was this Purusha Prakriti play. But I didn't know about this aspect here of this Ishvara Shakti. Because Ishvara is Purusha who contains Prakriti and rules by the power of the Shakti within him. The sentence contains Prakriti. So Ishvara contains Prakriti and rules by Shakti. But Shakti is Prakriti and sold by Purusha and acts by the will of the Ishvara. Yeah, one needs to make a diagram, a sort of mind map. I don't know.
So it's like they're both governed by the Ishvara Shakti.
Yeah. So Ishvara Shakti is still higher in the ladder of consciousness and Purusha Prakriti. I thought that Purusha, yeah. I thought that there was Satchitananda or Brahman, and then Purusha or the individualized Jiva. Yeah, well, this is a cosmology.
I think the Ishvara Shakti are right there in the Satchitananda.
Yeah, okay, but then the what is the difference?
They are the two in one. It's the bliss, it's the essence of being, right? It's a knowledge, being, bliss, Satchitananda.
Satchitananda, yes, it's existence, beatitude.
Being and bliss. Mm-hmm.
Being and bliss, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I have to study how the Ishvara Shakti stands in relation to Satchitananda and Prakriti. Okay, I will sign this and for the next time.
There's a gorgeous passage in Savitri that describes the two in one. I don't know exactly where it is. Maybe John Robert remembers that. the two in one, that out of the vibration of their bliss, the creation proceeds.
I think it's in the early, one of the first two cantos of Ashapati's really? Yoga.
Huh.
Yeah. Where he discovers this whole world, and he discovers the magnificence of the spiritual world.
Yeah, I think it's the chapter of the soul world. I don't know what it's called, but the yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's worthwhile stepping back a little bit and saying, okay, these are names. They're mental names. They're not, that doesn't mean they're objects, because that's what we think of as what mental names refer to, objects. These are not objects. These are more something like pointing. Look there. Yeah. But don't try to put boundaries around it. Or if you put boundaries around it, don't make them hard and fast. Like, this is the metaphysical final. These are just names of processes and of things that we can't really name, actually. So we do our best. And when we read something like Sri Aurobindo's work, he's transmitting through the mind, through the mental category, something that's beyond it, beyond the mind. So it's helpful, but it's not the mind, the outer form that he's giving us is only a way for us to realize something that's farther in, that goes beyond the words.
Thank you for that, John Robert.
You're welcome.
So to speak, he tries to trigger our intuition.
There you go.
To go beyond the mental categories, but yet titillating it through mental categories.
Very, very poetic, Marco.
Yeah.
Titillation.
Sorry, it's the only thing that came to my mind. It speaks by categories and very earthly analogies. Okay.
So I feel we are an hour, a little over an hour into it. I think it's a good time to stop. And then next time, it would be wonderful to read it again.
Yeah. I think it's better to go through it again.
Yeah.
This is certainly, I mean, Sri Aurobindo's poetic self is coming through all these philosophical distinctions, and he's a constant marvel.
It's even more surprising if you think that he went to England at the age of 7, I think. So English was not really his mother language or native language, but almost, yes. But it was not really his native English.
When he came back to India, he did not know Bengali.
He had forgotten
Bengali, so he was fully English.
His whole
mental development was in English.
Actually, in his home, his father insisted on in speaking English.
And
then when he was 5, he was sent to a convent school in the foothills of the Himalayas, run by English or Irish nuns, I think. And so that was also an English language environment. So English really is his native tongue.
It could be otherwise, because I mean, this is beyond. I'm not a native English. I cannot judge it, but I didn't find people native English writing with this style and with this power.
Nobody is Sri Aurobindo.
That there is, but I mean, just technically, the structure of the sentence, there is something special. There's a power, of course. Yeah.
Exactly.
But this use also of some certain words in precise position. Yeah, interesting.
Remember when he said that when he was writing the aria, which included the synthesis, he would just make his mind silent and it would come down.
Yeah.
He said he could have gone on like that for 70 years. It was only 7 or 8, I think, that he did it. But,
but this Shakti, let's call it that, this power that was writing through him must also find a vessel, a body, an instrument, exactly. Instrument that has been molded, that can be used. Because if he wouldn't have had that kind of education and that kind of preparation, he would have realized it for himself personally, but I doubt that you could put it on paper if you have not this skills that has been exercised from childhood. Okay, but it's not so important. It's just,
well, they came at this time because the time was right. They both came right in the middle of the 19th century, Mother and Shorbendo, within 8 years of each other or 6 years of each other. And they were right ready at the beginning of what we, some of us, consider the beginning of the Aquarian Age, where all of this started to pour forth into humanity, right? It is a transformative action of the Supreme, these two. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
Nobody else could have done what he did.
It was also at the time when the British Empire was the reigning, British were the reigning superpower, and so English. And Sri Aurobindo actually said that English had, and the English language had qualities that made it appropriate for his work. Which I thought was really surprising, you know, since he knew Sanskrit and he knew French and, you know, he knew what, 7 or 8 different languages.
Oh yeah, Latin and Greek and German,
But
I think English has the plasticity that was needed.
Yeah, but I think didn't that they the say things. that Sanskrit, they consider Sanskrit the ideal language in principle, that they, because I don't know if you saw his records of yoga. I bought both volumes of records of yoga, began to read a bit, but then I left it there because I don't understand the thing. It's all in Sanskrit, and so I think Sanskrit. Yeah, there's this discussion if there is a language, a sort of ideal language that can transmit best these things.
I think we got it in English right here.
You think?
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah, okay.
And everybody can understand English over the whole world.
Yeah.
It's a worldwide.
It's already a lot, yeah.
There's only be a handful of people who will study Sanskrit, you know, comparison to humanity.
Yeah.
So it had to be in English.
Sure. Ah, yeah. If it would have been in Sanskrit, no chance.
I wouldn't have known it. You wouldn't have.
Zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also these people who try to revitalize the Esperanto language. For decades, they have tried to do that. But
I know, it will never
happen. It didn't work out, no. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Sorry,
didn't work. No, I know that in India there are some parents that raise their children speaking to them in Sanskrit. I don't know if this is true. I've heard about that.
I don't know.
It would be interesting to see how this develops.
It's like what the people did in Israel. You know, Hebrew was also not a living language anymore.
Exactly.
And there was somebody who made it into a living, and now everybody's speaking
you
it.
You see, so it's possible.
It is possible.
Yeah, exactly.
They had an incredible national motivation, of course.
Yeah. That needs perhaps more motivation. Yeah.
The Irish have been trying to do that also.
Who?
The Irish. Oh, all of the high school students have to study Irish. And they even have retreats where they go away, because not all their classes are in Irish. They're mostly in English. But they have retreats where they go away where there's nothing but Irish spoken.
Oh, cool. Very good.
Interesting, yes. And I see that also in the U.S., there are the Indian Americans who are trying to.
Yeah, they need to keep their languages alive. Yes, it's essential.
But it's coming back, as far as I understand it.
Yeah.
It's coming back by them. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting. I find it nice. It's interesting. It's a colored world, even if I don't understand the word. But only the hearing them speaking is.
Well, I think there's something about each language that expresses something essential of the soul.
Yeah.
Of that nation, right?
Mother said, in the agenda, there's a passage where Mother said that all languages, that you can reach a supramental level where you understand every language. Because all languages, there's something, a core, which it contains the meaning of the word. What we perceive with our mind are only the words, but the meaning is wrapped into the words. And if you reach some supramental level, you can somehow get into contact with the meaning, and you understand the language without knowing the words practically. Something like that. I don't remember now exactly, but that's also very interesting. And she was wondering, How will these new beings, these Gnostic beings, communicate with each other? And she couldn't give an answer, a certain answer. She didn't know for sure. Maybe in Sanskrit or in Irish.
Or English.
No, in English it would not be original enough.
Well, there's nothing has been expressed like what Sri Aurobindo has been able to express in any language, not even in Sanskrit. What he is able to transmit in English is way beyond us.
But it's not about a language. It's vibration.
It's
transmitted through the language, but the vibration that is the thing beyond the language, no?
Language is a pretty good vehicle for him and his transmission, it seems.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So 22:22 and 22 seconds I see now here on the clock.
Okay, perfect.
It means something perhaps.
Why don't you start us with the meditation and then close it again after 3 minutes?
Yeah.
With your voice.
Okay. Ding. ding.
Nice.
Next time I will organize my bell a little bit better.
Well, and Jeffrey will probably be with us again.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lovely.
Good. Nice time. Good reading and
bye
discussion.
Bye. Yeah.